You can't imagine the sleepless nights for 30 years trying to hold on to painful memories because one day it might be important to be told in court. I was 23 years old. I worked third shift, 11 o'clock at night until 7 o'clock in the morning. It was March 11th, quarter after 7 in the morning. There was still a little bit of snow on the ground. As I stepped on the porch, Clyde was usually happy to jump all over me, but he cowered from me, and I thought, well, that was unusual. And I put the key in the door, and once I unlocked the door, then he was jumping all over me like, oh, thank God you're here. And I didn't think much of it at the time until I opened up the door. I stood in the doorway for a while. I didn't want to believe what I was seeing. My brain didn't want to accept what I was seeing. I was actually trying to hear her breath, and she just wouldn't breathe. Then all of a sudden it was, Christopher, is my son okay?
It was around 7:30 in the morning. Phone rang. Said somebody killed Marilyn last night. She's dead. And I just started screaming. Not Marilyn. Not Marilyn. I am Carolyn Ron. Marilyn McIntyre was my twin sister. Why would somebody do that to an 18-year-old?
It was a heinous crime, is what it was. I was there. I seen the body. My name is Lee Erdman, and I was the chief of police in Columbus, Wisconsin in 1980. We're looking for a mean individual, not a stranger. It's someone in the immediate family or a close friend.
I knew it was coming. The husband, 9 times out of 10, usually is the guy that did it.
I just automatically thought Lane. I'm Brenda Daniels, Marilyn's older sister. Brenda and I did not agree from day one who committed the crime. I couldn't tell you how many trips we made to Columbus Police Department. Same runaround. We'll get back to you. There's nothing new.
We never got enough information to secure a warrant for an arrest.
Somewhere along the line, Columbus dropped the ball.
After 1983, this case went cold. I am Wayne Smith. I'm a lieutenant with the Columbia County Sheriff's Office. We take some personal pride in not having unsolved homicides in this county. And here we find out there is one, and not only is it unsolved, but it's, you know, nearly 30 years old.
It was like an explosion. They thought it could be solved.
It's something that shouldn't have taken this long. There was only going to be one try at this. Witnesses were dying at this point. Memories certainly aren't improving after 30 years, so this was going to be it.
Last chance for justice.
Growing up in a small town, everybody knows everybody. It's been difficult, you know, not knowing exactly what happened.
Growing up in Columbus, Wisconsin, 31-year-old Christopher McIntyre thought he had an idyllic small-town childhood.
For the most part, I was happy and a normal kid growing up, just like everybody else.
Until the day when he learned an awful truth.
I guess I was about 9 or 10. That's when my father decided to let me know.
The woman I thought was my mother, I found out was not my real mother.
He told me, you'll never meet your real mom. She's gone.
Chris was only 3 months old and asleep in his crib when his mother Marilyn was murdered in 1980. His father, Lane, had struggled for years to find the right time to tell him.
I was waiting for him to get a little older.
That had to be really tough to hear.
Yeah, confusing and tough, yes.
She never got to hear Christopher call her mom. So much was taken away from her.
Carolyn Ron is Marilyn McIntyre's identical twin. Her world was torn apart when her sister was brutally murdered nearly 3 decades ago.
It was hell. I turned to alcohol. My marriage failed. I wasn't there for my children.
I think she feels like when Marilyn died, a big part of her died.
Carolyn's daughter, Tara Doucette, was born less than a year after Marilyn's death.
My first memories are seeing my mom crying on the phone about Marilyn.
As Tara grew up, she witnessed her mother's constant efforts to convince the Columbus Police Department to reopen Marilyn's case.
I couldn't tell you how many detectives we went through. We didn't know where else to turn, where to go.
In 2007, 27 years after Marilyn's murder, Tara decided to take matters into her own hands. She made a phone call that would prove to be fateful. Ironically, she called the wrong number.
I thought I was calling the Columbus Police Department, and instead it was the number to the Columbia County Sheriff's Department.
I had never heard that there was an unsolved homicide within the county. It wasn't in our record system.
After reviewing the case, Detective Lieutenant Wayne Smith made a crucial decision. The Sheriff's Department would reopen the investigation.
You could tell right away that they cared. They seemed shocked that it had went on this long.
That's right in the living room where she was found.
As Smith and county detectives began digging into the old case files from 1980, their first question was simple. Who was Marilyn McIntyre?
She was my best friend.
Marilyn and Carolyn Ron were born on November 14, 1961. Only 5 years later, tragedy struck.
Our real mother was killed in a car accident in 1966.
The twins, along with older siblings Brenda and Dean, were soon living with their father and an abusive stepmother.
It was physically abusive, mentally, verbally abusive. And it was mainly on Marilyn and I. And at the age of 13, we finally moved into foster care.
At age 16, Marilyn was looking for stability in her life, something she found in 21-year-old Lane McIntyre.
I was just enamored with Marilyn right away.
It was instant.
She's so pretty. I was like, just control yourself, you know?
It was love at first sight.
I wanted to take care of her, you know, be there for her.
But while Carolyn approved of the relationship, Marilyn's older sister Brenda was wary.
I just didn't think he was good enough for Marilyn. She had a rough life growing up. Was this guy gonna make it any easier? No.
Despite Brenda's concerns, the couple married on January 19, 1979, when Marilyn was just 17 years old.
It was a small party, maybe only a dozen people, but it was one of the happiest days of my life.
Soon, Lane and Marilyn added a new member to the family when Christopher was born in December of that year.
That coming summer was going to be the best summer of our lives, being husband and wife with our brand new baby.
The evening of March 10th, 1980, started like any other night in the home of Lane and Marilyn McIntyre.
We did laundry, and then I left for work.
Do you remember the last thing you said to Marilyn or what she said to you?
She said, I love you. Do you love me? No, of course I do.
The next time Lane saw his wife, she was dead.
And what did you see when you walked in?
A body on the floor with a knife sticking in the side of her chest and a mutilated head.
Lee Erman was the Columbus police chief in 1980. He found it significant that there was no sign of forced entry or a robbery, indicating that Marilyn knew her killer.
Speculation was she might have answered the door and let someone in.
Betty Klentz, who lived in the apartment above the McIntyres, learned about Marilyn's death from Lane himself.
It was about 5:10 after 7. Somebody pounded on our door downstairs. It was Lane. And he said, did you hear anything last night? He said, I just found my wife murdered.
By the time Chief Urban knocked on her door, Betty remembered that she did hear something unusual in the middle of the night.
About 3:15 in the morning, I woke up and the dog was just barking up a storm, and it was like he was pulling on something.
Whose dog?
Lane and Marilyn's.
And was it unusual?
Well, I'd never heard him bark before like that.
Based on Betty's statement, police believe the murder occurred around 3:15 in the morning, a time when Marilyn's husband said he was at work.
I never left.
Lane did, however, give police their first big lead.
When they asked you who might be a suspect, you gave the name Kurt Forbes.
I did?
Yeah.
I don't remember. I probably did.
Did you consider Kurt Forbes one of your best friends?
At that time, yes. At that time, I didn't know what he was capable of. I was just mystified. I'm just trying to understand why. Why to Marilyn?
As police were running down Lane McIntyre's apparent alibi for the night his wife Marilyn died, he was offering them another suspect, one of his best friends, Curtis Forbes.
Why would Kurt Forbes kill your wife?
I believe that Kurt Forbes had a crush on Marilyn, and his girlfriend just left him, and he was on the prowl that night.
That's our engagement picture.
Curtis Forbes was engaged to marry 22-year-old Debbie Adelson in March of 1980.
You know, I was young back then, in love, and he was what I wanted in my world.
The couple hung out frequently with the McIntyres.
We'd play cards, or we'd go fishing, we'd go out to eat. We got to be really close friends.
But according to Lane, Marilyn soon heard some disturbing news about Kurt.
Debbie began to tell Marilyn stories about abuse.
Lane says Debbie confided in Marilyn that Kurt would occasionally beat her up, and that just days before Marilyn's murder, Debbie broke up with Kurt.
Had Marilyn encouraged Deborah to leave?
Yes.
Kurt?
Lane believes the newly single Kurt Forbes was looking for some action on the night Marilyn was killed.
And then he goes, aha, I'll go check on Lane's wife. Lane's at work. I believe he had the intention to rape.
Former police chief Lee Erdman questioned Kurt about his whereabouts on the early morning hours of March 11th.
He said he had went out and proceeded to play pool and have a good time.
According to witnesses, Kurt tried to pick up a woman at the bar. She rejected him. When the bar closed at 1 a.m., he drove to the house of another woman, Lori Heft.
I was home with my then-boyfriend.
According to Lori, Kurt arrived around 1:15 a.m. and stayed just a few minutes.
Why do you think Kurt stopped by your house that night?
I think that he was going to probably try and make sexual advances towards me.
After leaving Lori's, Kurt said he drove to Debbie Adelson's house, arriving after 2 a.m.
But when investigators talked to Debbie Adelson and her parents, what time did they say he arrived?
4:00.
So there's 2 hours.
Yeah.
Unaccounted for.
Yeah. Where did he go? What did he do?
And then, just one day after he was grilled by police, Kurt Forbes skipped town.
Innocent people don't run. Kurt Forbes ran.
Kurt soon sent letters to Lane and Debbie.
Dear Lane, I don't know how to express my sympathy for you at this time. I don't want to go to jail for something I didn't do.
There's too much circumstantial evidence against me, so I have to go.
But what was the circumstantial evidence against him that he's talking about?
What people were saying, that he was violent.
Debbie initially told police that Kurt had arrived at her parents' house at 4 a.m. on the night of Marilyn's murder, but later said she might have been mistaken.
It was either 10 after 4 or 20 after 2. I just saw the two hands.
The circumstantial case against Kurt seemed to be weak, and police soon learned that none of the physical evidence taken at the crime scene could be linked to him either. After 2 months on the lam, Kurt returned to the Columbus area, and just 5 months later, he and Debbie Adelson were married.
Did you have any questions about marrying him?
None.
But you knew other people were talking about him.
I think that back then it was more, they were talking about Lane.
And in fact, around Columbus, suspicion had begun to shift away from Kurt and back towards Marilyn's husband.
I thought maybe Lane did it.
Betty Klintz had always felt uncomfortable about her neighbor's calm demeanor when he came to her door the morning of the murder.
If I was him and it was my wife, I probably would have started in like this. You know, my God, I just came home from work and I found my wife murdered. But no, he just said it in a nice, calm voice.
Betty told the police about frequent fights that she heard between Marilyn and Lane.
Neighbors say that you guys would argue.
That's their speculation. The McIntyre family, we're boisterous. We talk loud in our house.
And Marilyn's older sister, Brenda, who had never liked Lane, believed he had a motive for killing his wife.
Lane looked at me and he goes, Brenda, guess what I did? He goes, I took out a life insurance policy for Marilyn.
It turns out Lane had purchased a $10,000 life insurance policy for Marilyn less than a week before her murder.
3 days later, she's dead. I was mortified.
And that wasn't all. Within months of Marilyn's death, Lane was dating, and he soon remarried.
He was just getting on with his life, like it was nothing.
I'm a young man, I've got a 3-month-old baby. I needed another woman in my life.
Although there was suspicious circumstantial evidence against both Lane and Kurt, the police did not arrest either man. Instead, their investigation mysteriously ground to a halt.
4 years go by, 5 years go by.
Our thoughts said it would never be solved.
For Lane, each passing year brought increased scrutiny.
My own son was taught to think I did it.
Things started to go sour between me and my father.
Did you ever just say, Dad, did you have anything to do with this?
I did not. It'd be such a hard question to ask. Dad, did you have something to do with killing Mom?
At age 15, the tension between father and son reached a boiling point, and Christopher moved out of the house.
I lost mother, and now I feel like I lost father.
The toll on Marilyn's family would continue to grow.
You know, we've grown up in broken homes our whole life because they didn't know how to carry on after Marilyn died.
Years would turn into decades, and still no answers. Until that fateful call.
When I took a look at this case, my question was, why didn't he get arrested in 1980? I made a promise to the victim's family. We will do our best at this, and I believe when we're done, we'll be able to tell you who I believe did it.
In 2007, Columbia County Sheriff's detectives reopened the investigation into Marilyn McIntyre's murder. And after digging into the old case files, they found a piece of evidence that would soon blow the case wide open.
There was this very small stain in a bathroom sink that had the victim's blood in it.
In 1980, blood and hair samples had been taken from the crime scene. More than two decades later, that blood evidence was sent to the Wisconsin State Crime Lab for DNA testing.
When the report came back on that, there was possibly two other contributors. However, one of those contributors
was not Lane McIntyre. He was 100% excluded from that.
And is there any of the suspects a possible contributor?
There is.
When the lab compared DNA from a sample of Kurt Forbes' hair to the stain in the sink,
he was listed as a possible contributor in that stain.
But Wayne Smith knew there were limits to this DNA evidence.
You have to remember that, you know, this is likely a pinhead-sized stain in a sink.
And being a possible contributor was not conclusive proof. The lab results showed that it wasn't necessarily Kurt. The DNA could also come from one out of every 98 people.
But it wasn't her husband.
But it wasn't her husband, and it wasn't any single other person that had ever been mentioned as a suspect or had been in that house, because we tested them.
So Smith and county investigators focused their attention on Kurt Forbes and began to re-interview everyone connected to the crime.
I wasn't worried about not remembering.
Lori Heff told detectives that on March 11, 1980, Kurt stopped by her house at around 1:15 a.m.
He was there for 5 minutes.
She also recalled a conversation she had just weeks later with Kurt's girlfriend, Debbie Adelson.
She said, well, he showed up at my place around 4 o'clock with blood on his shirt and wanted me to take care of it.
I don't even know her.
Debbie, who was still married to Kurt Forbes in 2007, remembers that time very differently. She says there never was a shirt with blood.
So if Lori says that you talked about the fact that there was blood on a shirt, she's not telling the truth?
How can it be?
And in fact, when Lori gave police a statement back in 1981, she never mentioned a bloody shirt.
Why wouldn't you tell the police that she also mentioned blood?
I assumed that Deborah had brought that up.
Detectives heard other rumors. Family and friends of the Adelsons said that Debbie's mom talked about washing Kurt's bloody clothes that night.
We would love to have talked to her parents because I believe that they had really good information.
But unfortunately, Debbie's parents were no longer alive. None of the statements could be verified.
For some reason, this family wasn't interviewed about Kurt's arrival at their home. And that's a critical piece of evidence.
Detectives spent 2 years sorting through the evidence and interviewing more than 60 witnesses.
It got to the point where Kurt was the only one left to talk to at this point.
Finally, on March 24, 2009, 29 years after Marilyn's murder, Kurt Forbes was served with a search warrant and brought in for questioning.
Attorney Forbes, before you sit down, what I'd like to do, I guess, is go back to March 10, 1980, that night. He goes up to Talatea up for a little while, and then I left there.
When asked what time he arrived at the Adelson's house, Kurt remained consistent.
It was around 10 o'clock. So if she had told us that you got there a little bit after 4 and she looked at the clock, that would be inaccurate, or it was wrong.
After nearly an hour of questioning, Wayne Smith tells Kurt that his DNA was found mixed with Marilyn's blood in the bathroom sink.
How do you explain that your DNA is in her blood?
I wouldn't know. What are you talking about? My DNA is in her blood.
Wow.
As Kurt's interrogation stretched on, two other detectives visited his wife at home.
I was in shock. I didn't know what was going on.
She agreed to answer their questions, but didn't realize the interview was being recorded.
I know you know that we've reopened this case.
She was asked about Kurt's rumored bloody shirt.
Did it have blood on it?
I don't remember that, no. I can't say.
You can't say or you can't remember?
I can't remember.
As detectives continued to push Debbie about the bloody shirt, her answers began to change.
He showed up at the house, bloody clothes, and your mom washed him. I know you know that.
But I just don't remember right now.
But you just said yeah.
Finally, after more than 4 hours of questioning, Debbie's memory of that night seemed to return.
He had a white shirt on underneath the blue sweater, and I saw blood in there.
You did?
Now I remember that. I know I asked about the blood, and he told me some bull. I can't remember what he told me. and I believed it.
I couldn't stand up.
Hours later, armed with Debbie's damning new information, detectives arrested Kurt Forbes for the murder of Marilyn McIntyre.
I knew 100% Kurt Forbes was the one that was responsible for this murder.
But making that case to a jury was about to get much tougher. After a judge ruled that the crucial DNA evidence that seemed to place Kurt Forbes at the crime scene would not be allowed at trial.
It was devastating, and I thought there was a greater chance that he'd get away with it.
It's like we got him. We finally got him.
29 years after Marilyn McIntyre's murder, her family believed detectives finally had the right man, Curtis Forbes. Even Marilyn's sister Brenda, who had long suspected Lane McIntyre, was convinced.
Is there one moment, one piece of evidence that made you change?
Yeah, when the bloodstain hit Kurt's DNA in it.
But then, a judge threw out that DNA evidence, ruling it was not conclusive enough to be used against Forbes.
Is our job tougher? Absolutely, but that doesn't mean we can't get it done.
Assistant Attorney General David Wambach decided to move forward anyway with a completely circumstantial case.
We're behind Kurt 100% in this ordeal.
Kurt's brothers, Mike and Dennis, believe the charges should have been dropped.
Well, I am angry, you know. They threw my brother in prison for nothing.
But on November 9th, 2010, Curtis Forbes goes on trial for murder. It begins with a dispute over when Marilyn died, an important issue since Lane McIntyre has an alibi for the hours between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m., while Kurt Forbes' whereabouts are in question.
So what time do you believe that Marilyn McIntyre was murdered?
I believe that it's sometime very close to 3:15, and that's why Clyde the dog is acting up the way he is.
That information came from the McIntyre's upstairs neighbor, Betty Klentz.
I had to get up around, between 3 and 3:30 because the dog was having such a fuss outside.
And there's a second witness, a friend of the McIntyres, who drove by their house twice on the night of the crime. First at around 12:30 a.m.
Did you notice whether or not the lights were on when you went past to go home?
No, I didn't see no lights.
Then again at around 3:15.
At that time, I noticed the porch light was on and the dog was tied outside.
That evidence, says the prosecutor, proves that Marilyn had to be alive between midnight and 3:15 a.m. on March 11th to turn on the light and let the dog out.
A cat can go in the litter box. The dog, you gotta let him out.
But the defense says Marilyn died earlier, before Lane went to work. They point to the testimony of the McIntyre's other neighbor. She lived next door to Lane and Marilyn and heard a noise coming from their apartment at 10 p.m. on March 10th.
We went to bed and we could hear voices like they were maybe arguing or something.
But that was all the neighbor heard. And Wambach reminds the jury that Marilyn had a 3-month-old baby who needed to be fed every few hours.
You're saying somebody would have heard that baby crying.
Exactly. And we knew that none of the neighbors had heard any crying.
Wambach now moves on to the next important point in the timeline. What time did Kurt Forbes arrive at Debbie Adelson's home that night? At 2 a.m. or 4 a.m.?
If he actually got there at 2 o'clock, then it doesn't look like he's the one to have committed the murder.
Because Debbie says she could no longer be sure when Kurt turned up, the prosecutor calls witnesses who spoke to Debbie back in 1980 about Kurt's arrival.
What time did Debbie say Kurt showed up at her parents'?
I believe it was around 4 o'clock in the morning.
She said it was at 4 o'clock.
About 4 o'clock in the morning?
For Kurt Forbes, the case hangs on this one question.
Where was Kurt from 1:30 in the morning to 4 in the morning?
I have no idea. We never asked him.
With his case winding down, Wambach knew that his most crucial witness was also the most unpredictable.
I didn't ask for any of this.
On the day of Kurt's arrest in 2009, Debbie Forbes told detectives that she had seen blood on Kurt's shirt on the night of the murder. But on the stand, Debbie now denies she saw anything.
Did you see anything on his clothing that you took notice of?
No.
You did tell them that Kurt had blood on his shirt that night.
I don't remember saying that. And I know I didn't see it. And how they got me to say that, they could have gotten me to say anything at that point.
Did Kurt show up with blood on his shirt? The prosecutor has one final piece of evidence he believes provides the answer.
Debbie, what's going on?
A prison phone call between Kurt and Debbie Forbes recorded just 2 days after Kurt's arrest.
The facts are, Deborah, I did not murder Marilyn McIntyre.
Then where did the bloody shirt come from?
I'll explain all that. I did not kill Marilyn.
Well, explain it to me then.
I'm not on the phone. I need a lawyer, Debbie.
What's so beautiful about it, too, is what it doesn't say. He doesn't say, what blood? What do you mean, blood?
But Curtis Forbes' attorneys downplay the call. They point to the fact that there was no physical evidence linking Kurt to the crime scene.
None of the hairs were consistent with Curtis Forbes.
And then, to create more doubt in the mind of the jurors, the defense calls an unlikely witness, Lane McIntyre.
I knew I was going to be grilled and I didn't care.
Forbes' attorney wastes no time putting Lane in the hot seat.
Approximately 3 days before the death of your wife, did you have occasion to talk to an insurance agent?
Yes.
And what did you do with relation to that insurance agent?
He showed up on my doorstep, unannounced, solicited me. You're a young man starting a young family. You need life insurance.
Lane is peppered with questions about finding his wife murdered.
I stood in the doorway, trying to accept what I was seeing.
About pointing the finger at his best friend.
Did you tell officers that a person they might want to look at was Kurt Forbes?
Yes.
And about whether he and Marilyn argued before he went to work.
You do not recall an argument that you had with Marilyn McIntyre on March 10th, 1980, between the time you got home and the time you went to work?
No.
He was trying to accuse me of killing Marilyn and then going to work like nothing happened.
As the trial comes to a close, the jury must decide, is the right man on trial? Did Kurt Forbes kill Marilyn McIntyre? Or did her husband, Lane?
Hopefully, Marilyn gets the justice that she deserves.
On November 15, 2010, after 6 days of testimony and more than 45 witnesses, the fate of Curtis Forbes is in the hands of the jury.
We thought it was going to be an all-night thing and we'd be back in the morning.
Instead, the jury is out just 2.5 hours.
I'm thinking this can't be good.
The families of Kurt Forbes and Marilyn McIntyre,
we got a verdict,
scramble back into the courtroom for the verdict.
It was probably the scariest point in my life.
Everything at that point is resting in that moment for the judge to read the verdict.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Curtis E. Forbes, guilty of first-degree murder.
It was just like,
dated this 15th day of
wow. We just went nuts.
All this pain that I had to carry, this baggage, I could finally let go of.
For Marilyn's family, it's the end of 3 decades of pent-up anguish.
Justice for Marilyn, finally.
Finally over.
Oh, my God. It's finally over.
But on the other side of the courtroom, where the Forbes family sits,
he is innocent.
It was just unreal.
Devastation.
They found a guy guilty of murder, gonna put him in jail for life, and only deliberated 2 hours on circumstantial evidence?
Get out of my face.
It was a quick verdict, in part, says prosecutor David Wambach, because the jury believed there had been a bloody shirt.
If you can convince them to say, I have no doubt that Kurt Forbes had blood on him and that that was Marilyn's blood, everything else just falls in behind that.
There was never any blood.
But even today, Debbie Forbes insists that she never saw blood on Kurt that night.
When you, though, called Kurt on the phone, you asked him.
Then where'd the bloody shirt come from?
I'll explain all that.
Yeah, I wanted to know about this bloody shirt everybody was talking about. I hadn't seen one.
Do you believe that Deborah Forbes lied on the stand?
Well, yes. She committed perjury. I don't think that the jury found much of anything that she said or did to be believable.
But Debbie now no longer seems willing to protect the man she married 30 years ago.
Do you think you know the truth now?
It's in there. Just have to accept it.
It sounds like, Debbie, you do believe your husband killed Marilyn McIntyre. It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Three months after the verdict, Kurt Forbes is sentenced to life in prison.
Whatever tiny little bit of doubt I would have had in my mind was clearly pushed out.
Finally convinced of his father's innocence, Christopher McIntyre is looking forward to repairing their relationship. So is Lane.
Marilyn would want her son and her husband to be the best of friends. We got a lot of catching up to do.
Following the sentencing, Marilyn McIntyre's family visits her final resting place.
They're beautiful. Yellow is her favorite color.
Justice for Marilyn.
Justice for Marilyn.
They release balloons. And with them, more than 30 years of pain and frustration.
If you can imagine being judged when you're telling the truth for 30 years.
I'm over.
And then finally, after all these years, finally, vindication.
My mom can start a new life. Our family is gonna start a new life now.
Queen.
This family was persistent.
Detective Lieutenant Smith and Assistant Attorney General Wambach are quick to acknowledge that without Marilyn's family, her murder would never have been solved.
It's to their credit that they kept this case alive.
If it took me till the day I died, I was never giving up. Don't ever give up.
Because eventually somebody does have to listen.
You are the victim's voice.
She's still watching us.
Marilyn would want us to have closure. There are so many people that love Marilyn, still do, always will.